Welcome to Invisible Tears. I'm Jane, host of Invisible Tears, and I'm here with Amanda and Drew. Hey, guys.
Hey, how's it going?
Doing good.
Good.
Doing good.
What'd you think of the end of the race this weekend?
I don't want to talk about it.
No.
Oh, you know, I don't know how many Hamlin fans we have out there for NASCAR fans. Mm-hmm. But I'm not a big Denny Hamlin fan, and to see him already win two races, I wasn't a very happy camper. I take that shit seriously, you know. I'm like, what the hell?
Yeah,
I'm not a big fan of his. But...
seeing Troy throw his little hissy fit was kind of entertaining.
Yeah,
that was. I was like, wow, is he gonna start fighting people? I was really surprised with what he did to Larson.
Yeah, that's him.
Yeah.
That's him.
Yeah.
So he doesn't have very many fans. It's interesting when I'm at the track and they do drivers, announcers. He is one of the ones that are booed one of the most when he comes out.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got such a crappy attitude, you know?
Yeah.
So yeah, I'm not a big fan of his. And when I'm not a big fan of the drivers and they win, I kind of like, I get a little pissy myself.
She takes it personally.
I do. Yeah. It's like, but you know, people are out there saying, yeah, but he is a good race car driver. He's a whine ass. Race car driver. Not a very good example for the younger ones. I think he sets a very bad example for the kids.
Now, who is your favorite driver these days?
Well, I love Larson.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Elliot. I mean, mm-hmm. Chase Elliot. Everybody loves him. They have good attitudes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
They really do. Once in a while, you might see a little frustration on the track, but I mean, that just goes along with anything. I mean, you could be one of the nicest liked people at work, and if you're having a bad day or whatever, you know, you're going to be a little pissy. And
yep.
So that's pretty much them. All in all, they're really good role models for the younger kids that want to get into the racing and stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, them are my two buddies. All the rest of my buddies have retired to show my age. They are since long gone. No more racing. No longer racing. Some of them are dead.
Yeah, we watched that special on Netflix, you know, kind of following last year's playoff run. To be honest, I had fallen off of watching NASCAR for years and years. And I was like, when I saw Jeff Gordon, I was like, holy shit, that made me feel old, because that was kind of like the era when I, you know, kind of was watching as a kid and had kind of gotten out of it. And then this year when we did the party for Daytona at your house, just watching it, it got us hooked again. So we've been mm-hmm. watching it this year and getting cool. back into it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I like Blaney. It's just funny because through that documentary, they actually just kind of like outlined, you know, kind of like their lives and stuff like that. I was like, they're just so cool and like down to earth. I was like, he just seems like a really cool guy. But I like Larson too. He always has his like kid like in his arm. You know what I mean? He's like a family man. So.
Yep. When we go to the races at Loudon every year, they do a benefit track walk. And one of the drivers takes the time to do the track walk with everybody. You pay $25 and it goes to the Children's Foundation that they sponsor a lot.
Nice.
And Blaney did the walk with us twice. Oh. So we got to meet Blaney twice. Super, super nice guy.
Yeah.
Like really approachable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, just... he seems like you and me. He doesn't.
That's the vibe,
you know,
I got.
Not intimidating, yep. or anything right. like that. Mm-hmm. And just a nice guy to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That was the vibe I got through the documentary. Plus, him and his girlfriend have horses. They live right in North Carolina, and they have horses too. I was like, oh yeah, horse people, of course.
Yeah. So yeah, I do like Blaney. He's pretty cool.
Yeah.
All right. So we're gonna do we're gonna talk about Melissa Tremblay's murder today, which is kind of interesting because her case went cold for years.
It did.
And then off and on they picked it up and started investigating, had a few people of interest. And after like 34 plus years, they got a DNA hit.
Yep.
And somebody was actually arrested. So we're going to get into that. You know, who was Melissa Missy Tremblay? She was an 11-year-old sixth grader from Salem, New Hampshire. She attended the Lancaster School. A friend from her school said she was pretty. She loved feathering her hair back, which is funny. I did too in the 80s.
Oh, yeah.
She was also known to dress funky and cool.
Mm-hmm.
11 years old, funky and cool. Jeez. She was featured in a WMUR news story, Channel 9 News out of New Hampshire, before her death. She was looking for a match in the Big Sister program. She told News 9 she wanted to be a secretary when she grew up. She told News 9, quote unquote, "I love to type a lot, and when I write, that's pretty good. And I'd like to learn to do shorthand too," quote unquote. She was also known to be bubbly and fun. She loved music of the 80s and loved listening to Madonna and Wham.
Of course.
She was an only child. Her mother had adopted her. Her mother, Janet, unfortunately passed away in 2015 at the age of 70. On September 12th, 1988, her lifeless body was found near the old Boston and Main Freight Terminal on Andover Street in Lawrence, Mass. She was lying face down between two train cars on the tracks, one of her legs severed by one of the passing trains. The authorities later determined that she had been stabbed to death and then placed on the railroad track in an attempt to disguise her murder as an accident. There was also evidence of a violent struggle nearby. Melissa's life was a bit chaotic. She lived with her mother. Unfortunately, Melissa was left frequently unsupervised to wander the streets of Lawrence, Mass. When her mother would bring her to meet with her boyfriend at the LaSalle Social Club in Lawrence, this is where Melissa was last seen alive. Nearly 34 years passed with no arrest until April 26, 2022, an arrest was made. They arrested Marvin C. Skip McClendon Jr. Who was Marvin Skip McClendon Jr.? Well, he served 4 years in the U.S. Air Force. In 1965, he graduated from Tewksbury High School in Tewksbury, Middlesex County, Massachusetts. On December 24th, 1985, he married Doreen McClendon in Pelham, New Hampshire. While working as a carpenter, he was affiliated with a church in Lawrence, Mass, and living in Chelmsford, Mass. He allegedly killed Missy Tremblay, 11, of Salem, New Hampshire, who was found dead at the Boston Marine Railroad Yard in Lawrence. He worked at various times for the Massachusetts Department of Correction until 2002. In 2003, he filed for divorce from Doreen in an Alabama court stating he had seen her. He had not seen her since 1988 and did not know where she was living, which is really weird.
Mm, yeah.
So he took off. He must have taken off to Alabama.
Yep.
Without her.
Mm-hmm.
On November 23rd, 2005, he and Sharman McClendon got married in Cullman County. They lived in Bremen. No, it's Bremen,
Alabama. Yep.
From 2007 to 2016, he had numerous violations for not wearing a seatbelt. I didn't like wearing a seatbelt. Should have moved back to New Hampshire. In 2014, he filed for divorce from Sharman. On October 12, 2014, his father, Marvin Carton Clendon, died in Alabama at the age of 88. On April 27, 2022, he was arrested in Brendan for Missy's murder and booked into the Cullman County Detention Center in Alabama. He was transferred back to Mass in May of 2022. In September of 1988, when Melissa was murdered, he was 41 years old and known to be a very angry and violent drunk who frequented the strip clubs and had relations with women in the back of his van. Now, that's very important to point out.
Yep. So as Jane had mentioned, in May of 2022, Marvin was extradited back to Massachusetts to face first-degree murder charges for the murder of 11-year-old Melissa Tremblay. It was on May 13, 2022, that Marvin faced a judge in Lawrence District Court that read the charges of first-degree murder against him. Marvin was seen as expressionless and entered the plea of not guilty. It was during this hearing that the prosecutors revealed a few things. First, that DNA played a major role in his arrest. Second, that it was believed that the killer was left-handed based on wounds Melissa had suffered, which Marvin was, in fact. And lastly, the witness had seen Missy near a tan-colored, significantly rusted van on the day of her death, and Marvin drove a vehicle that fit this description. Marvin was held without bail pending his trial and was placed in protective custody in the prison since he has worked there for many years. Marvin's trial started on Thursday, December 7th, 2022. His defense attorney emphasized in the opening arguments that the DNA evidence did not uniquely identify Marvin as the killer and that his only crime was his last name, McClendon. The prosecutor spent 7 days calling witnesses and experts to testify, trying to solidify their case and put a timeline to Melissa's disappearance and the foul play that incurred. What was outlined as a timeline was the following. On September 11th, Melissa and her mother, Janet, drove from their home in Salem, New Hampshire, to LaSalle Social Club in Lawrence, Mass., to meet with Janet's boyfriend, Ronald. This was a fairly common occurrence, as it was common for Janet to bring her daughter with her. Once they arrived, Melissa was given free rein to wander around Lawrence. A resident in the area, Lisa, recalled that afternoon seeing Melissa, that she had stopped by to look to see if she could play with her four children. She had become friends with them throughout the years, but that afternoon, Lisa sent her away because her children were grounded. After that, the bartender at LaSalle Social Club made Melissa some popcorn, and she told him that she would be right back, but she never returned. A railroad employee said that he remembered Melissa hanging around the rail yards that afternoon around 3 p.m. He told her to leave the area because it was dangerous there. Around 4 p.m., her mother started getting worried because she hadn't returned. So she, along with patrons and staff of the club, started to look for her. At 5:30 p.m., a couple saw Melissa speaking to a man in a tan, rusty van at a nearby intersection. They recalled the man looked unkempt, big, dark in complexion, dark hair, and seemed to be in his mid-30s. By 9 p.m., when they couldn't find Melissa, her mother called the police and filed the missing persons report. At 8 a.m. the next morning, Melissa's mom, Janet, teamed up with some friends to go look for her. By 5 p.m., Melissa was found at the rail yard, murdered, and they had no answers.
And so back to the trial. The prosecution first called numerous witnesses. The retired detective that responded to finding Melissa, or was part of the finding team. The B&M rail yard worker who actually called in finding the body. Lisa, the mother of Melissa's four young friends. And Donald, who was a bartender at the LaSalle Social Club. When during the examination, Donald actually recounted that he would see Melissa often in the bar by herself eating snacks, sometimes for up to 5 or 6 hours at a time. When Donald was actually asked by the defense lawyer if he had ever remembered encountering anyone named Marvin, Skip, or anyone with the last name of McClendon, he said that he didn't. On day three of the trial, too, someone called Daniel Hatch was called as a witness. He was 13 back in 1988 when Melissa went missing, lived around the area. He recounted that he remembered seeing a girl sitting on the steps outside the LaSalle Social Club that evening, and he recognized a man that was sitting next to her as someone that his family had warned him about to stay away from. This man was called Mike Therrien. He then saw them 10 minutes later walking together away from the club where they joined another man. Now, the timing of this testimony didn't really make sense because according to Daniel, it was about 7:30 at night when he had seen her. So when by 4 p.m., Melissa's mom, Janet, along with the rest of the staff in the club had already started looking for Melissa. So the whole testimony kind of put the whole timeline in question throughout the trial. Daniel also didn't come forward with this story until 2013 when he had actually been arrested and then finally decided to share this story with the police. On day four of the trial, a supervisor from the Mass State Crime Lab took the stand and explained the DNA testing that was done on Melissa's fingernail clippings. The DNA collected was a match to all the members of the McClendon family, including Marvin, all the male members. The forensic genealogy company that helped develop the profile was a company called Identifiers. Days 5 through 7 of the trial, the prosecution called Marvin's ex-wife to verify that he was left-handed and proceeded to call several other male family members of Marvin's to essentially prove none of them were present in Massachusetts in 1988. After the prosecution rested, the defense called their own experts, including a forensic pathologist named Jennifer Lipman. She reviewed the autopsy photos and said she could not determine if Melissa was attacked from the front or the back and had no opinion about the dominant hand of the attacker. They also summoned an expert on genetics, a Dr. Frederick Bieber, who said that, and this is a quote, "Everyone sitting in this courtroom has 800 to 2,000 living relatives," end quote. He was simply implying that the DNA under Melissa's fingernails could match hundreds of people. Marvin did not testify in his own defense. After this, the jury deliberated, and on Wednesday, December 27th, the verdict was delivered back to the judge that they were deadlocked and they could not unanimously agree on a verdict. So the judge declared a mistrial and dismissed the jury. Essex County does plan on pursuing a second trial against Marvin for the murder of Melissa, but as of this date, it hasn't been scheduled. Marvin remains in jail awaiting his retrial, proclaiming his innocence with failing health. Melissa's family and friends believe Marvin is responsible for Melissa's death. They were disappointed with the mistrial, but know in their hearts that the right man was on trial for her murder.
Now, I also read somewhere that he was a person of interest back around 2002, somewhere around there between 2002 and 2014, when a new detective came in from the cold case unit and started looking at a lot of stuff. He was immediately a person of interest.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's been since. It wasn't like they jumped on him when the DNA came in. He was already a person of interest. The DNA was just like almost a confirmation.
Yep, that was my understanding too. He was always a person of interest, but there was really nothing solid, you know. There was, you know, witness statements, but some of them kind of, you know, some of them said one thing, some of them said another, you know, so there really wasn't anything tangible until they got a handle on the DNA profile.
Because to me, it's not just the DNA. I believe there's a couple of other pieces that fit him into that puzzle of being guilty. And I wonder if, because they focus so much on the DNA, if the jury was like just so focused on that, they didn't think about looking at other pieces.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors. And now back to our episode.
Now, do we know, I have not been able to find online, but do we know how many were guilty and how many was not guilty?
Oh.
Holdouts were there.
You mean like how many people on the jury said guilty and how many said not guilty? I wasn't able to find that data.
Yeah, exactly. No, I wasn't either. And I really looked hard.
Yeah, I don't know if they would necessarily make that public if it was deadlocked. I don't know.
They have before.
They have before?
I've read a few cases where they have. But Massachusetts could be different too. I think it's different in each state.
That's true.
But I would be curious to see how many holdouts were there.
Right.
Because like with a murder case, all it takes is one holdout.
Right.
And they can't convict. It has to be an acquittal.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder how many holdouts. Because I really think that they just, you know, I want to assume that they focused a lot on the DNA instead of looking at the fact that people saw the van and, you know, other stuff like that.
Yeah. 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 It does really sound like they really tried to link really tried to focus on that DNA and really actually try to forensically link when, unfortunately, I mean, yes, there was a DNA. It was nice that there was a DNA profile like created, but it wasn't actually a full, you know, a full comprehensive. Yeah. It didn't exactly point to him. Like the profile said, any member of the McClendon, a male member of the McClendon family. So that's kind of, it's really not a specific DNA.
But Amanda, don't forget that they were looking for someone left-handed. And he was the only one that was left-handed. So that was kind of a red flag to me. I wonder if they send it out because there's more, there's other DNA testing that they can do that can get more specific with matching DNA.
Right.
And I wonder if they can send that back out to see.
Yeah. And I'm surprised that they didn't do that before bringing this to trial. The fact that it was brought to trial in 2022, late of 2022, is what was the need to rush it to trial if you didn't do the complete DNA, you know, analysis to see if it truly did match 100% or if it's just within this genealogy?
Yeah, they could be in the process of actually trying to do that. And that's why a retrial hasn't been rescheduled yet. You know, they could be.
Yeah,
I would hope they would.
Could be, because I mean the first trial to me seemed rushed. Like all of a sudden they arrested him, they transported him here to Massachusetts, and next thing you know he was indicted. Like that took no time whatsoever to indict him. But then immediately after that there was a trial. Seemed kind of rushed to me.
I mean it was essentially the trial itself. 9 days, I think.
Was
9 days of calling witnesses and, you know, witnesses presenting evidence and then cross-examining. So,
Well, it's too bad that, you know, her mom has since passed. So her mom won't see justice. There's been a lot of judgment towards her mom.
There has been. There has been, yeah.
You know what? It's not up to us to judge how she parented or what she did. I'm sure she's had a lot of years to live with a lot of that guilt. And I don't think, you know, any of us have a right to judge. It's not like she knew that that was going to happen.
Right.
But unfortunately, mom has passed and never seen justice, which is too bad. But I guess some friends started social media pages for Missy. Mm-hmm. And kind of made it look like family had kind of forgotten about her. And there's been an uncle and an aunt and a few cousins, especially when the arrest was made, have definitely come forward and said, hey, yeah, we're here. Mm-hmm. And we've thought about her a lot and mm-hmm. Have always hoped for some kind of justice for her. And so, she did have family that loved her, still loves her, miss her. Mm-hmm. Her life was cut so short, 11 years old. I look at when I was doing research and looking at her pictures and looking at the video from WMUR, mm-hmm. actually has a video of her being interviewed just before she was murdered. I look at Cheyenne, my granddaughter, 10 years old, mm-hmm. and I think, oh my gosh, yeah, so young,
and bubbly.
So little. Bubbly and mm-hmm. wanting her to fly and
right.
Funky and cool in her own sense.
Yeah, funky and cool. I love that description of her.
Yeah.
But I mean, after all these years, it's nice to see that her case did have eyes on it.
Yes.
And they had been investigating it off and on, and she was never forgotten, right. Which was, when cases get old, that's the first thing that you worry about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if the public forgets about you, do the authorities forget about you? And obviously, she's never been forgotten.
Right.
And she deserves some kind of justice.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, she'll find it. But I mean, of what I've read and what they have for evidence, and I hope they rerun that DNA.
Yeah.
But I see him guilty. Listening to what they found out about him and some things that fit,
mm-hmm.
I would think he's guilty.
It was interesting. There was even a quote from him when he was arrested down in Alabama before he was extradited up here. There was a direct quote from Marvin himself, and he said, well, at least I got 20 years of my pension. Like, it was just such like a matter of fact, like, well, at least I've been free for this many years and could get this much of my pension. Like, it was an odd quote. And I know that Melissa's family has clung on to that too and been like, that was certainly an admission kind of, you know, in our eyes. So,
yeah.
But with a retrial, you know, that they haven't, you know, scheduled the retrial yet. But so with a retrial, there is the ability to bring in more information and more evidence. So if anybody has anything else, now is certainly the time to come forward and speak with police too.
Absolutely. What do you think, Drew?
What do you guys make of that, the witness testimony that kind of changed, that could possibly change the time frame of her disappearance? Do you think it was somebody who maybe got the days mixed up, maybe didn't actually see her, saw somebody, something else? And as you've been able to state, he came forward with this in 2013. So that was 25 years later.
Mm-hmm.
How much detail changes in your mind over 25 years?
Right.
Yeah.
It's you don't, with somebody coming forward with some sort of information like that, you don't want to necessarily discount it, but at the same time, so this individual, he was 13 at the time, and he even self-admitted was like on his way home to get a screwdriver to like break into cars. Like he was like, you know, like committing crimes like around. And when apparently the next day when she actually, when it was all over the news that she was actually murdered, you know, that she had been missing and she was actually murdered, he actually confided in his brother, and his brother told him, like, it's not your business. Like, don't tell, like, you, like, stay out of it. Like, it's not your business. So I'm not sure if maybe it was like a confession of like, it's true. And like, it's a confession of like, oh, okay, well, I'm already, you know, arrested for this and da, 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 and, you know, this has been weighing on my conscience and this is what I saw. Or if it was possibly him trying to, you know, give some sort of information to lesser his charge for what he was being charged with. Like, it's really, it could really go either way.
Yeah, that's what I think. I feel the same way. It could go either way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, obviously he was in the area, and obviously this, you know, stuck with him all these years.
Mm-hmm.
Did he say, "Oh, wait a minute, I can, you know, I'll bring this up
mm-hmm.
to try to get a plea deal or whatever,
right?
Lessen my sentence," or did he say, "You know, I'm not going to listen to my brother anymore, and I'm going to come forward with this information"?
Yeah,
I feel the same way. Could it go? It could go either way.
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the pieces that sort of like distorts the possibility of the timeline not being the timeline that was put out there. That could have raised question, right?
Yeah.
So, but I mean, in thinking about it, if his account was correct, then almost the entire timeline of when everybody apparently started searching for Melissa was way skewed, right? It wasn't 4 o'clock in the afternoon. It wouldn't have been until, you know, 7:30, 8 o'clock, that sort of thing. So,
yeah,
I don't know. What do you think, Drew? You asked, what do you think?
No, it's bad to say, but do we know for a fact that the mother and the patrons of the bar started looking for her at 4 o'clock?
Not sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if that witness observation was true, then by translation, you would say that they didn't then. But don't know.
So when the couple saw Melissa speaking to the man in a tan rusty van at about 5:30 at the intersection,
mm-hmm.
What was the details behind that?
That actually was the only details that I had.
Yeah.
It was literally just a couple saying that they had recognized her and they had actually witnessed that. There really wasn't any other details. The intersection that occurred in was right near the LaSalle Social Club.
Yeah, all I could find was people described it as a white van.
Oh, okay.
Some said tan, some said white, but had said that the van had been seen in the area. I didn't read any specific time or where it was going or where it was coming from, or all I read was the van was seen in the area
mm-hmm.
that day.
Yeah, I was just wondering if it was one of those like, okay, we actually didn't really start searching until 6:30, but let's tell authorities and tell people we actually start at 4:30 because it doesn't make us look as bad for even more unaccounted for hours of where Melissa was
right
that afternoon. If that recollection by Daniel Hatch is true, because it is one of those where, like you said, there was something that was happening in his life that day that made it memorable. He saw the news coverage, so he was able to actually remember what he was doing that day. And especially recounting seeing this gentleman, Mike Theron, if you have those sketchy characters, mm-hmm. you kind of remember that seeing them interacting with kids. So it could have very well been a lasting where he's like, nope, I know on this day at 7:30, I saw somebody talking with him. You know, does that make it a little bit more credible, or is it truly just has his days mistaken?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep. Don't know.
And I wonder if it truly was this McClendon guy and he was, you know, a child predator. They don't just stop. So you wonder, are there others? You know, when did he move to Alabama? I mean, obviously, why did he not? My big question, too, was why did he not see his wife over all those years?
Yeah.
And then decided to meet and, you know, divorce her.
Yeah.
And he didn't know where she was. And that part is very suspicious to me.
Yeah.
Did she know more? Did she know anything? Did he threaten her? You know, did they interview her?
Yeah.
Because I think she would have been a very important part of this case.
So, do we have another male who lived in Massachusetts whose wife just took up and left in 1988? Now, what's Nicolau's story again?
Oh God. Dude, this is exactly where you were going.
When did his first wife disappear?
His first wife disappeared in November of 1988.
The hell was happening in Massachusetts in 1988?
I know, huh?
I know.
But you kind of wonder, you know, are there other victims?
Yeah.
Have they started, you know, investigating down in Alabama when he first got down in Alabama? You know, were there other victims?
Yeah. You would hope that someone would.
Yeah, was
So.
there anything possibly tied to him beforehand? Because what was he,
Yeah.
41 at the time of Melissa's attack?
Yeah, 41. Yep. He was 41, part-time or carpenter, correctional officer off and on. I tried to find some information on that too. And there wasn't a whole lot. Like, I couldn't find out, you know, exactly where he was a correctional officer, for how long, why was it off and on. If he had ever had any, you know, write-ups for misconduct with any of the inmates, because he was known to be very angry drunk. So I wonder, you know, if you get more into that, why was it off and on? And you know what years, but there's not a whole lot there.
I couldn't find any detail on that either.
And say a McClendon being angry and drunk. It's not very surprising.
Because honestly, I really wanted to find a picture of him when he was 40, 41. That would have been right around the time that he was a correctional officer, which would have been right around the time of my attack. Even though my attacker didn't drive a van, you know, maybe he had access to another vehicle. I don't know. But I was really trying to find, you know, if he was a correctional officer back in the 80s, you would have thought they would have had some kind of picture on file and stuff because he was an official, you know, a law enforcement official. But unfortunately, there's no picture out there of him when he was in his 40s.
Yeah.
Interesting, because you kind of look at, you know, that picture of him and look at the picture of my attacker, the
The
picture
sketch.
we did. Yeah. If anybody's got a picture out there of him when he was in his 40s, send it to us.
Yeah.
We'd love to see it. So unfortunately, he was acquitted. Hopefully, when they do the next trial, they'll find him guilty and he will die right where he deserves to die, in prison. And they're working. He'll be on the other side of the bars.
Yeah. It's also interesting to note too that because of his past employment there, he does have to be in, but not just because of his past employment with being a corrections officer, there he has to be in protective custody, but also with what he's charged
Yeah.
with, you know, charged with killing an 11-year-old girl. So with both of those, they've kept
Yeah.
him in protective custody.
And his health is frail. 'Cause he's what, 74? How old is he now? He was 41 in 1988.
77, 76.
Yeah, I was gonna say 77. And I think I remember seeing one of the articles. I believe it actually said 76 when he was extradited up here. He was right around that age, so he's right between 76, 77, I would think. No.
Well, find guilty before he decides to kick the bucket. Because did you know if you die in jail, that case is dropped and they are never found guilty?
Yep.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
Because he can't defend himself. Yeah, well, Missy couldn't defend herself either. She was only 11.
Yeah.
So I don't feel bad for him at all. I hope he stays right where he is. Yes, I am very bitter with this one. She was freaking 11.
Yeah.
God, that bothers me.
Yeah.
So if you have any further information on this case, we will put up a 1-800 number for the state, Massachusetts State Police. We'll put that up there. Until next time, don't forget, subscribe, share, check out all our social media, and have a good day.
Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of Invisible Tears. Make sure you subscribe to our podcast to hear all future episodes. Click into our link tree too in the episode description to find and follow us on all our social medias. And it also links to our website, invisible-tears.com, where you can keep current on any events that may be coming up, read more about Jane and the team, and read more about all the Connecticut River Valley unsolved cases. Evil may exist in this world, but we will not let it win. See you next episode.